Okay, so well, thank you for coming. And I figured once in a while I should give a talk. I haven't given actually. I gave the first talk, which was just on general turbulence, very general, to the whole audience, to everybody, which was one of those Blackboard lunches, which we should have again because they're really. I have to talk to David. Maybe have more of those because they're really good. I mean, they're really good because you don't use the slides at all. You give Blackboard talk to everybody. As everybody asks and the room is full and so on. So let me talk about, this is not about convection. This is about fully developed turbulence or whatever, R lambda roughly 300, 400 Taylor microscale Reynolds number. The work is done by Kelkin Chang and Greg Bewley, and I'm also hanging out with them. And this at Göttingen. And we have get money from different sources and have different affiliations and so on. So, I mean, you know, of course, turbulence, you have the boundary. So turbulence in general, this is Greg's talk. So turbulence in general is anisotropic, as we know. It's not actually this perfect isotropic homogeneous turbulence that we all envision when we do the numerical simulations or when we do experiments. We try very, very hard to make it isotropic. And so the typical state that turbulence is anisotropic, for even behind a grid, initially the turbulence is quite anisotropic. And of course, we always have large-scale sweeping, and inside that large-scale sweeping, we have large scales which are not isotropic, and then at the smallest scales, we hope that things isotropize at the smaller and smaller scales. And so the question is, can we say something about anisotropic turbulence that's really anisotropic, and can we change the anisotropy of the turbulence and see what happens at the small scales as a result of this? And so what we asked ourselves is, well, can we generate flows at the large scale where the fluctuating velocities, where we use the fluctuating velocities as a measure of the anisotropy? So we make axially symmetric anisotropic turbulence where the fluctuating velocity in this direction and the fluctuating velocity in this direction is different. And we just take the ratio of these two and we call that, you know, whatever, this is the anisotropy. So what that means is we can make things that are elongated where the fluctuating velocity is large along the axis, or we can make it flat where the fluctuating velocity is large in the radial direction. So these are the two situations we will consider in this talk. And or we can make it, of course, isotropic. So we can go from anything where the velocities look pancake-like to something where it's perfectly isotropic and to something which is, you know, very, very anisotropic in the axial direction. So what we are studying is axially symmetric anisotropic turbulence. And of course, we still would like to have this turbulence to be well-behaved, homogeneous, and so on and so on. And so the question is, how can you realize this experimentally? By the way, just ask me. So what we know, of course, from turbulence, you measure the two-point statistics. What you can measure is either the structure function or the correlation function. And we know for anisotropic turbulence that from this work by Chandrasekhar, that there is two independent scalar functions, Q1 and Q2, which can then describe this turbulence quite well. The problem is that this is very, very hard. They're very hard to measure experimentally. And we also have the structure function, of course. For isotropic turbulence, we have the relationships, you know, that epsilon r to the 2/3 is the second order structure function. We also have the third order structure functions. And we can relate, of course, the dij with the fluctuating velocities this way that I've been writing it over here. So what we did is we built what we call the machine or the soccer ball. And so we made an experiment where we used the ideas from Eaton and Ray Shaw and other people to use loudspeakers to generate a turbulent flow where we can tune the anisotropy. So how does it work? So we have here this thing. This is about a meter in diameter. Some of you might have seen this. It's made of wood because it was easier to build. In each phase of this soccer ball, we have a loudspeaker. So we have 32 loudspeakers, and each loudspeaker is basically just a pump, and it pumps air in and out. So we use it at 50 hertz carrier frequency, and we change the amplitude of that pump, and we put a funnel in front of that loudspeaker. And by putting this funnel in front of the loudspeaker, we are generating a turbulent jet. So there's a carrier frequency of about 50 hertz, and then we have a correlated noise of about 0.1 seconds, and we digitize our amplitude at 2 kilohertz, and at any digitization, we make sure that the total amplitude stays constant. So in other words, we make sure that each loudspeaker that moves in a little bit, some other loudspeaker moves out at the same time, so that overall the flow stays incompressible. This is very important, because if you don't do that, you set up large scale flows in your systems, and you get you have a large scale mean flow, which we don't want for our measurements, because we want to really just study the turbulence while it sits there. We don't want it to be carried along. And so basically, so this is important. We adjust the amplitude of the, we adjust the amplitude of this. At any given time, we adjust the amplitude of these modulations so that the total amplitude, the volume of the ball, is conserved. So we, yes?
What is the velocity more or less at the nozzle?
Oh, God. The fluctuating velocity is about up to meter per second in sight. So this is probably a meter per second. Right? So the travel, they travel about a centimeter, the loudspeakers, and they're about 10 centimeters in diameter, and so we should be able to calculate it, but I can find out. The orifice, so we have a loudspeaker, so what happens, of course, is when this thing blows out, we get a turbulent jet. When it goes back, it sucks in the air from everywhere, including here through this opening. So this way, we basically, it's like you're breathing, you're sucking in the air from everywhere, but you're pushing it out everywhere. The turbulence, by the way, is most efficient, is most strong, of course, when the sound is very low. So we looked at this, so the sound field is much, much weaker than the turbulence field, but it's loud. After all, the room will be at about 120 dB. So, if I talk really loud now, I could do that, but it's quite loud. But it's you can really tune the system. You should also be careful when you build a system like this. You can run the system like a drum, where it goes boop, boop, boop. And then what you do is you introduce smoke rings, vortex rings. And you have interacting vortices. We have tried to generate turbulence that way too, so interacting vortices, to see whether it's any different. But if we drive our system without destroying the loudspeakers, the highest Reynolds number we get is lambda 50, which is really not a very well developed turbulence. This is a very, very weak turbulence. Okay, and so what we do is we can change the anisotropy in such a way that we can go from this, what we call pancakes, to cigars. So we can go from things that are elongated this way to things that are elongated that way by just adjusting these amplitudes. And we can do that by just adjusting the different loudspeaker amplitudes at will in such a way that we get a certain axial symmetry in the flow. And in addition, we can keep the total energy, fluctuating energy in the system, constant. So we're basically trying to get the energy we input into the system constant, and by just tuning the loudspeakers, we can tune the anisotropy. It will. Yes?
Say something more about that. Was that trial and error, or is there some theory behind?
No, this is doing measurements and actually calibrating the system. So you have figured it turns out it's not perfect, because what we really adjust is the amplitudes of the loudspeakers.
It's trial and error.
It's trial and error. Initially it was trial and error, right? Calibration, right? It's trial and error. You try it out. What is the what's important is how you drive the correlated noise, the correlation time of the noise you put in. You have to take the right model to do that. It's all in the JFM paper that we have submitted. I can give it to you.
Does it mean that actually the integral scale of the turbulence is something like 10 centimeters?
Yes, it will be something like 10 centimeters. It's actually going to be about 7 centimeters, but it's going to be different in different directions, and that's a big point of the talk, that the energy, the integral scale, is going to be different. So this way, we then what we do is we do LDV measurements, so laser Doppler velocimetry measurements in this experiment, and so we put in basically oil from a commercial fog generator, which has particles which are much, much smaller than the Kolmogorov scales. Kolmogorov scales are 50 microns, the particles are about 1 micron or less. And so by doing this, we really have traces in the system. We don't have to worry about settling and things like that. So we are pretty sure that what we measure is real. It has to do with this. So the way the problem is, we use we have a 1D LDV probe, and we have a 2D LDV probe, which limits us to the measurements that we can do. You can only measure the transverse velocity with an LDV probe. You cannot measure the longitude, the one which is coming at you. You cannot measure that, because you don't get a Doppler shift, and so, or a frequency coming through the optical system. And so what we measure is we have a 2D probe and a 1D probe. And so what that means is we can only measure the transverse the transverse velocity fluctuations, but not the longitudinal velocity fluctuations limited by this observational system. And also here we can only measure one component, and here we can measure two components of velocity. Okay? So the one trick is, what we do is we have a translation stage here, and we move one of the components with the translation stage, and this way we can measure at two different positions the transverse velocity fluctuations. So u at r and u of x plus r, and we move it along r, but we only have it along a line. And now, of course, what we have is we have in one direction 1D, and the other, and we, let's say we have a cigar like this, then we could only measure in one plane, right? This way. So what we do is actually we turn the cigar, instead of turning the optics, we just turn the cigar. And so what we usually have is we can make an axial and a radial cut. This is what we investigate through the turbulence by rotating the axis of symmetry, not of the observation system, but of the turbulence. Since it's so symmetric, we just drive different loudspeakers, and by driving different loudspeakers, we basically can turn our axisymmetric turbulence into the plane, and then we just use the same system. And so what I will report are radial cuts and axial cuts. This is all what we have measured with the LDV system. So we have the you know, what we do is to measure the axial cut, we basically just turn the cigar, you know, this anisotropic object, the velocity, we just turn the turbulence in such a way that we can measure basically the axial fluctuations and the radial ones. And so this way we can basically measure that pretty precisely. The problem is we're a little bit off, so we have to keep in mind that we cannot turn it 100% because we would, after all, it's a soccer ball, it's not a sphere, and so we have a slight asymmetry, so it's not perfectly axial and not perfectly radial, but it's pretty good. Okay, so for example, what we do is we have here, this is the turbulence, and these are the two, this is the separation vector where we can measure. So this is the one LDV system, and then the other LDV system is right here. So we have these two systems, and then what you can do is you can just turn the turbulence, and then you have the separation vector in this direction, or you have it in the other direction. So that's the main trick of the experiment. Okay, here are the statistics. So what you have to ask yourself, how good is the flow behaved? And now what you have to do is you have to, of course, look in the center of the experiment at a different location, and what you find is that, you know, these numbers are all, so this are, let me see, so what is this now? This is the velocity statistics at different, let me remind myself what this is. So this is, oh yeah, this is the mean flow here, and these are the fluctuating velocities, and what you see is the fluctuating velocities in the center are pretty close to each other. So for an isotropic situation, then the system is very much isotropic and the mean flow is actually zero, right? So this is an isotropic case, this is not an anisotropic case. Okay, which means we can make very nice fluctuations. And so this is now the ratio of uz over ur1, so one radial direction, and uz over ur2 in another radial direction, measured, basically it's the shape of turbulence, measured as a function of the ratio of the amplitude of the forcing. So this is this L. So this is the amplitude in the axial direction, the amplitude in the radial direction. And so this is basically the shape of the forcing. And so what that means is, this is in the middle of the flow again. And so what that means is we can just tune by changing our amplitudes. This is what you were asking for, right? By changing this ratio of the amplitudes, we can just tune this thing along.
What is UDS? Is this RMS?
Pardon me? This is URMS, yes. This is URMS in the Z direction, and URMS in the radial direction, in the different directions, so it's basically this way and that way, and we just do two. But what you notice is that the red and the blue spots are pretty close on top of each other, which means it's pretty good, pretty well axisymmetric, at least in these two directions that we have measured, which are perpendicular to each other. Okay, then what you can do is you can come up with a table, you say, you know, what is the ratio of the fluctuating velocities, and you see we go here from where the z direction is much smaller than the radial one, to situations where the z direction is twice as high as the radial one. Now you have to remember that the French washing machine that we usually report data with, remember all the acceleration measurements, everything that we report where we have this French washing machine, there's a 40% difference between the axial component and the radial component. So anything you have seen out of coming out of our French washing machine experiments is actually for anisotropic turbulence. It's axially anisotropic turbulence. It's actually not from an isotropic case, which would be here where it's just, you know, where it's just one. So one is not perfectly one, it's 0.94. This is the ratio of the mean flux and so on and so on. So but the time scales are very small, the Kolmogorov scales are fine, and so deny. And so, well, it doesn't, let's say, always allow, then it's gone. Okay, and so what you have there now is you ask yourself, well, is this flow homogeneous, right? Can we do anything? And so this is, remember, this is now the ratio of the two velocities to each other, right? So these are basically things that look like a cigar, these things look like a sphere, and this here, the anisotropy, looks more like a pancake, right? So one time the fluctuations are the same, one time one fluctuation is much higher than the other, and so on. And so what this tells you is, so this is this is as a function of z, so we walk up in the z direction, but this is the radial velocity, because we can only measure transverse velocities, right? So this is the radial velocity divided for ur1 and ur2 as a function of z, and you see that definitely for the different u's, this thing is flat, which is nice. And then this is this is the quantity of uz prime squared over ur prime squared. So this is again the ratio of the magnitude of the fluctuations in the z direction as a function of r.
Is r separation from the center?
Yes. It's always from the center. So basically all it says is we take this ratio, we move away from the center, and it doesn't change much. Which is good, right? Because that means the anisotropy is observed all the way out to roughly the integral length scale, which is about 50 millimeters, so 5 centimeters. So this flow is, you know, is pretty nice. You can go further. Now you see that there's a slight variation. This is now homogeneity. So what we do is we say we measure this thing at the position 0, which is at the center. Now we measure the radial fluctuating velocity as the position z. And we ask ourselves, how does that ratio change? It should be 1 if it's completely homogeneous. Well, it's slightly inhomogeneous by about 4% for this anisotropy. For the homogeneous, even for the homogeneous case, there's a slight, you know, anisotropy from let's say 2%. And then this case actually happens to be fine. I don't know why, but this is just what comes out of it. Now, what you can also measure is the uz prime of r1 over in terms of, this is a function of z going up, and now we go along the radius, and again you find that the variation is of order possibly, you know, up to let's say 6, or this is even going down quite a lot, right? I mean, here the anisotropy, if you go out to 50, the inhomogeneity is picking up.
Then you also measured from some center or what?
It's always measured from the center of the apparatus.
Ah, that's why it goes down.
So zero is the center of the apparatus.
Center.
It's always the center.
The maximum of your, it's always maximum in the center.
Yeah, it's always maximum in the center. This is where all the jets from the different loudspeakers are hitting each other. Yes?
You go only 5 centimeters from the center? I mean, I think the experiment is so much.
We go all the way out, you will see in a moment, we go all the way out about 10 centimeters, but then you already see that this thing, you know, falls down. Mm-hmm. So it's clearly changing, right? The anisotropy, the inhomogeneity is picking up the further you walk away, but it doesn't seem to be too important, but let's see. So you're right, we have been measured out to about 12 centimeters. It's the maximum we have gone, 120 millimeters. And so, well, so the question is, of course, you know, this is trivial, so what you can write down is you can write down the Kolmogorov constant, and you write that in real space, and then the question is, you know, what is this constant C2 doing? And, you know, there have been measured tables by Srinivasan, who has analyzed this, and he finds that this is about, you know, this constant, 4 times this constant is about 2, and so our C2 should be about 2, and these two-dimensional spectra usually come out pretty well, that this is about two, and the question is, what does it do for our experiment where we change the anisotropy, what do we get? And so what you can do is you can measure this, and so what we, since we have only transverse components, what we do is we measure along the radius the z component, or along the z direction the r component, because it's the transverse structure functions. And if you put that in, you would expect a, you know, the, let's call this z2 of r and z2 of z, and they should both scale as to the 2/3 power according to Kolmogorov. And so the question now is that true? So here's an experiment where we looked, this is a different experiment, this is one of those French washing machines with high tau, where we looked at the Lagrangian structure, second order structure function, and the Lagrangian second order structure function for the French washing machine is very, very different. You see that? I mean, the second order structure functions don't collapse at all in the Lagrangian frame. So we already know that we shouldn't expect possibly that this works in the spatial picture, but since we had before very good data also for the French washing machine, so here what I show you is, so this is again the second order structure functions along R, it's a function of R in the Z direction. This is the second order structure function of the velocity fluctuations in the R direction, in the R direction along Z, and if we divide these two by each other, then if one, that means we don't see any anisotropy. And indeed, we don't see any anisotropy up to 1, 2, 3, roughly 3 centimeters, which is about almost the integral length scale. This data just collapses completely. Over here, we have measurement problems from the LDV system because you can't get the light spots close enough together. While out here, we of course have very nice resolution. And what you can of course show is that the second order structure function should go with the correlation function, and when you go far, far away, the correlation function should just decay, and so what you should just recover is the fluctuating velocity, which the ratio of the fluctuating velocities, and this in this case would be 2.9, so this data would should go up here all the way to 2.9, this one should stay at zero, and if I go to very large, you know, very large separations, this thing should all the way go to 0.35, which is down here somewhere.
I'm supposed to pay attention to the left side of this figure.
Actually, you should pay attention from now on. You should only pay attention to this side of the figure.
Now it's all beautiful.
Right? Not the left side, because the left side, we cannot resolve the small scales because the laser Doppler system has a certain light spot and we cannot get closer, that there's a technical problem and the noise goes up and we don't get good measurements, while the inertial scales we resolve fully and even up to very high scales. And the question is actually a little bit about, can we do something about this? What can tell that to us? Because when I calculate an integral length scale, I'm actually integrating out to those scales, where I have to do some model to integrate out to those scales.
Sorry, in that figure of LG, eta.
Pardon me?
What length scale? How large is it in that figure?
Oh, in that figure, eta was 150 microns. So okay. This is 1 millimeter, right? So it's way down here. It's way down there. So we have a nice, definitely a, well, this is very seducing because you see a beautiful collapse of two curves, which actually don't show a 2/3 scaling, but if you divide them by each other, they're beautiful.
That's always, right? If you divide, it's better.
Yeah, it's better. You get rid, so big part. So this is how the truth looks. So this is the second order structure function normalized by R to the 2/3. By the trivial scaling, and what you find is that, you know, there's as a function of an isotropy, so this is basically, you know, here's isotropic, this is a pancake, this is a cigar, and what you find is that in the z direction, the velocities in the z direction along r, okay, they basically have little bumps, and interestingly, you know, these bumps, actually the maximum moves a little bit to the left, it moves a little bit to larger scales, and then here it's even worse. This is the DRR, so this is the radial fluctuations in the Z direction, so you're basically looking at the radial differences in the Z direction, and then what you find is it moves a little bit over, but we can define very well this maximum. Right? So what we can say, well, let's say, what now, what if you want to calculate a Kolmogorov constant, what you can say is, well, let's just take these maxima, and plot the ratio of these maxima and see what the values are to see whether there's a constant or whether it changes. And so what we find is that if you take, you know, basically you say you divide these two forms with each other, with the normalized with the epsilon to the 2/3, and what you find is that these constants basically, you know, wobble around about as a function of the anisotropy, just wobbles around about plus minus 5%.
You measure cross correlation. Could you measure cross correlation?
Yeah, sure. We could measure cross correlation. So right now we have measured autocorrelation. So I will talk about this now. So what that means is the second order statistics in the inertia range is pretty much isotropic, right? So in other words, it's a very insensitive quantity to probably residual anisotropy if there's any. And so the question now, of course, is correlation functions. Can we calculate the correlation function? And I don't think I have to remind you that the correlation function of our flow, the integral scale, is basically just the integral from 0 to infinity of the autocorrelation of the correlation function of R as a function of R. And so you basically integrate just out to infinity. And there's the Taylor microscale, which was invented by Taylor, who just does a parabolic fit to the first decay of the correlation function. And this is the Taylor scale. So the challenge for us now is to integrate the integral length scale. Now the problem, of course, is that our L is cut off by the size of the experiment. At 12 centimeters, this is the end of it. There's nothing to do. In a wind tunnel, you don't have that problem because the wind is coming by for infinite times. And so you can say my tunnel would be infinitely long, which of course it isn't, but locally you can assume because the wind is coming by, you do Taylor flows and Fourier hypothesis, you can actually calculate this thing out for very, very long time intervals, which is very long distances. Now this experiment, it's a finite experiment, so what do you do? And so let's look at the correlation function. So this is the now we have to look a little bit, concentrate a little bit. So this is again the correlation function of the R velocities as a function of Z. This is the correlation function of the Z velocities, right, as a function, the fluctuating velocities as a function of R. So this is the isotropic case, and the isotropic case pretty much is on top of each other, right, which is what you would expect. But in the anisotropic case, if I have a pancake, so that means the fluctuating velocity in the R direction is larger, the correlation function decays slower as a function of Z, then the correlation function in the Z direction. So they just interchange each other. Right? And the same thing you observe in the other direction, right? The black curve is now over here, the other one is over there. And so, of course, you're tempted to collapse all these things so that they're on top of each other, and you ask yourself, how can we do that? What do we get out of this? So
you rescale Z and R with the degrees of anisotropy.
With some L, you know, with some scaling factor. But let's see where we land. Because then now it gets more interesting. And so what you can do is you can ask yourself, well, since our experimental data only goes up to 110 millimeters, as Fritz has pointed out, right? What do you do about the longer scales? Well, now you can say, well, you know, you go in the literature, you read all these papers by Comte Bello-Corson, which is a great, great source of wisdom, and basically even they say, well, if it's a finite system, in some sense, for any finite system, you can interchange the integral and the correlation function should be zero, but let's just forget about this, okay? Let's put this aside and assume some decay and just do the actual integration and you get actually a finite number. Okay? And so what you can do is you can say, well, let's just take a fit and go out to the largest point we can measure and then just assume that it's an exponential. Now, of course, this is a transverse structure function which should be negative, right? It should actually tip negatively. And so here you have our wind tunnel data at R lambda about 400 with a passive grid in our SFX tunnel. And as I said, we can go out to much, much, much longer, larger length scale. So this is comparable. And what you find is that if you put this on this plot, what you find is that our actual data dips a little bit below and then comes up. But this is wind tunnel data. This is not coming out of this loudspeaker experiment. And if I do an exponential fit, of course, I ignore this negative part. And so the question is, how big is that? And so what you can do is you can say, if I do a cutoff at a certain length scale and I do an exponential fit, what do I get? And what you find is that the this is a the extrapolated length scale over the length scale is initially, because you do an exponential, you're taking away the negative part, and so what you find is basically you find at this distance you're actually correct, and then here you get an integral scale which is a little bit too large, and here you get an integral scale which is a little bit too long. But the variation out here, if we go to this region here, the maximum variation we would expect if we are actually going out to about to this point over here, which we can resolve in our experiments, that means we make a 10% error on the integral length scale, which is not a big error. So if I'm just interested in the, it gives me an error bar on the integral length scale, which is about plus minus 10%. Okay, so if I plot the integral length scale, it gives me an error bar. So if I do an exponential fit, it's pretty good. I get a 10% change. And so what I then can do is I can calculate the ratio of the integrals that I do with an exponential as a function of the anisotropy. And what I find is I find a curve that looks like this. Now, as you will in a moment see, if this would be Kolmogorov, you should see a 3 here, a minus 3 instead of a minus 2. I will show that in a second. You will understand where it's coming from. Epsilon to the 3 halves.
Yeah, of course it's 3.
It should be 3. Right, exactly. Just the square root of 1/3. Exactly, just the square root of 1/3. And what we find, though, is basically a factor of 2.2, roughly 2, not 3. And so now the question is, you know, why would that be? You know, what is so funny in our flow that you get this? So in other words, what this means is if you calculate the integral scale for an experimentalist to calculate the integral scale, it really tells you something about the large scale anisotropy of the system. Remember, we now have to integrate out to the large scales, which is further out. So now I'm actually interested, where Grisha pointed out that we're not interested in this, now I'm interested in actually this region where things start to deviate, because I'm getting into that region. Remember, 12, up to 5 centimeter, our second order structure function, you know, up to 1, it was okay, it collapsed, but if I carry my integral out to where I actually measured, things are becoming very anisotropic. So let's just see what we get. So we get this factor 2.2. So what we assume is, well, let's just assume that there's a scale factor A, which allows us to change the different isotropies back to each other. And so what that, in other words, means, since now, when Greg wrote this talk, he says, oh, for small r, for r goes to 0, that's really not r goes to 0. This is r in the inertial length scale, okay, not in the dissipation scale. So this is a very well-developed inertial length scale, small enough to see that the ratio of dNn in the one direction over the other direction is 1. In that case, what we see is that this ratio has to be 1. In other words, if I write down my correlation function, my structure function, 1 minus the correlation function divided by 1 minus correlation, it should go like the ratio of the velocities. It's trivial. It's really nothing. It just says that what I observed experimentally, dividing the two, it's 1. And what we also assume is that, well, you know, in the inertial length scale, we would assume that the structure, that we get a decay of the correlation function, which goes like, you know, of the structure function should go like r to the 2/3, for example. And in the Kolmogorov scaling, but let's just leave this n open for now. Let's just say we don't know. Let's just make this as an ansatz. And so what you can say immediately is that, well, you know, if I take the length scale, I just make it's trivial that you get a ratio of A coming out of this, because you can just carry the integral through. And if you do that, all that means is this A carries through also to the inertial length scales, right? So this is this factor that I chose, the stretch factor is just the ratio of the integral length scales. And of course, since I know that this thing is 1, that means this B1 over B2 has to behave like U squared over U1 squared. There's just no other possibility, because this thing was 1. Now, for small r now, of course, the factor A is related to this factor B. For small r means it going down in the well-developed inertial scale, we can just write down that 1 over A is also the ratio of B1 over B2, which means, trivially, that L1 over L2 should go like, as Krisha pointed out, should be like U1 over U2 over 2 over N, where N is this power law which I put into here, right? So if you put in 3/2, you get 3.
2/3.
2/3, then you get 3. Okay, so let's just check different things. So let's say the first thing we have to check is it true that we can just put in a scale factor in the correlation function? Do the correlation functions collapse? If I come up with a scale factor A, the next question was, are the structure functions, when I divide them, 1, which is okay. We have done this. This is Greg's symbol for okay. And then we have this is not a cross out. This is actually a okay, okay? It looks like you were really angry crossing something out. And then this is the Paolo scaling for small r. Again, that means, do we see an r to the 2/3? Behavior or not, right? Do we see that? And so we walk through these three again. So the first one is, we, as a best guess of A, we just take L, right? And so what we do is we just measure the integral length scale, and we collapse our correlation functions with the measured integral length scales. And indeed, the data collapses amazingly well, and it collapses even out to, for some realizations of anisotropy, we have measurements at these 12 centimeters, which go out about 2.5 or 3 L. And so even out here, the data collapses even better than it collapsed in the inside. So this means the large scales are extremely important, and we can collapse even the large scales just by doing the scale factor. Okay? Now, you already noticed that the collapse in here is not that great. Right? And so we have a problem, we will have a problem right in the inertial range, actually, by doing this. But let's just see it. And so what we also know is that we can just take this ratio, as I've shown before. This was okay, right? This worked. This was point number 2. This is point number 3. So the question is, do we see a r to the 2/3 scaling? And so what we did is here, we just collapsed all the data we have. We take all the data we have for all different anisotropies, and you write down the second order structure function, right, in R, and then we just say, do we get R to the 2/3 scaling, right? This was the assumption. Independently of any scale factor A, it should just work, right? It should. And so what you see is they all lie very much on top of each other. So what we do here now is we average all curves. Now this is an important step. We just average them, okay? Let me see where it leads me to, okay? I should mention that you guys should not then criticize me and tear me apart as much as you can. I'm looking forward to that. And so what we then do is we say, well, if we do this, this is the locus slope of this curve. Right? Now this is the locus slope. So this is the typical locus slope of my second order structure function, which I arrived at by just averaging these curves. And well, you know, there's not really a very flat plateau there, right? We don't see it. And if I take the wind tunnel, by the way, at R lambda 300, well, it's not much of a plateau either. It's better, but notice where the plateau is. You know, it's actually lower than 2/3 in the wind tunnel data. So you can say, well, I take this point, then I agree with Kolmogorov, I'm fine, or I take the maximum, you know. By rescaling these curves with any power law you want, you can always make a maximum, and you can always plot the maximum and make a ratio of the maximum. But it's only a maximum. It's not a scaling range. And so what that means is that, indeed, what I will show in a second is the following. If I take this power law 2.2 seriously, or 1, that means that I should be here in the locus slope, or here in the locus slope, or here in the locus slope, but not 2/3. So within our error bar, our turbulence, the analysis that we have done to get this integral length scale decay as a function of change as a function of anisotropy tells us that we are actually in this range here somewhere between 1 and about here. Now, of course, there's a little bit of a flat part, but it's just 2 points, right? So who knows what that means. But the main point now is that if I take this number here and I take my autocorrelation, my structure functions and reduce them by this scaling, they actually collapse pretty well. But you know, I could show you a similar plot with R to the 2/3, and it will also look pretty well. The question is, you know, which one do you want to see? Do you want to see 0.84 or 1, or do you want to see 3/2?
So these data are averaged over how much time? It's a statistically
steady. It's statistically steady state forever, yeah. So
you average over.
Oh yeah, this experiment takes forever because you're sitting there with a laser Doppler probe at 1 R, and then you just run this experiment, and you have to go to another position, you sit there, you go to another position and sit there. So it takes a very long time to take that experiment. So it's statistically mixed. Actually, I should go back. what this proposes here, what this says is that our loudspeaker system might not produce the homogeneous isotropic turbulence that we thought, you know, that there's an R to the 2/3 scaling, the Kolmogorov turbulence. Actually, this has a little bit of the signature of Vasilikos's, you know, tractic grid stuff that he's doing. So in other words, we might still be seeing the large scales. That's basically what it says. We see the large scales coming through the cascade. Well, the observed cascade. I'm not saying that this is a real cascade. So what we can do is that is we can say, well, let's just take this scaling with this scale factor n and just collapse all our data. So this is the full data, right? And now I say, well, we have just measured this, so this is G, that's the correlation function instead of the structure function, and you can do the same game, and you can put in this 0.84, and what you find is you find this collapse. Now please notice there's a very nice collapse out here at the large scales. This is the same thing for n equals 2/3. Now I leave it to you which one is better, right? I mean, to the eye it looks like, you know, this goes from 0.2 to about 0.45, this goes from 0.2 to about, you know, I mean, it's not much different, right? So in other words, these things are very insensitive to what you do in terms of scaling properties. But nevertheless, the 0.84 gives us a nice scaling. Of course, I wouldn't have shown this if that one wouldn't give exactly from our experiment. We get from the small scale scaling, we get 2.4. So this is the 0.84 number that I've been using. Of course, I could get anything too. This is 2.2 plus minus 0.25. So anything between 2 and 2.5 is allowed, right? But not 3. At the main point, it's not 3. And so what we get is here from the integer scales, we get this factor 2.2. So in other words, what we find is we find this behavior here. We have looked in the simulation literature. We have looked in the experimental literature. There's no other measurement of this. It's just nothing. Nobody has ever, other than, we couldn't find anything so far. We would wish that somebody else is looking at this feature in more detail and actually tries to understand how big the large scales are. We have talked to Craig Eyenk about this, and he has some papers on the influence on the large scale forcing on the small scales. And he says this is exactly a signature what he had seen more in the temporal space. You actually should see that in the simulations. If you force at large scales instead of forcing at the small scale, you know, the typically the delocalized forcing that has been tuned. So I would actually be very interested in seeing what happens when you introduce artificially anisotropy in numerical simulations and see how it carries through, and also see how whether the 2/3 scaling survives or not and how it's impacted by this. So, of course, now let's check the Taylor scale. Well, the Taylor scale works. There's nothing special. So what you can do is you can say, well, in the Taylor scale, you know that it goes like, it's just the parabolic approximation to our correlation function. If we do that for the anisotropic case, we know what the velocities are in here. We know that this is the case, right? Because we are right into the small scale regime where this is the small r regime where everything should work beautifully. We put that in and we put in these two relationships, and what you find is that the Taylor scales should scale like uz over ur to the power minus 1, right? This is just this because this goes here quadratic. And so you do that, you plug that in, and what do you find? You find a very nice collapse. This is the actual data, and this is then the data of the for small r just scaled by the fluctuating velocity the way you would expect it. So for the Taylor scale, there's no problems. Everything is fine. Nothing everything is okay. And so, well, it's almost fine. It's 0.291 plus minus probably 0.1. So it's okay, right? So the Taylor scales also show, of course, this behavior. But the behavior in this case is a power law minus 1 instead of a power law minus 2 or minus 3. Okay, so let me conclude, and we've submitted the first part of this without the large scale analysis to Journal of Fluid Mechanics. Well, we think this is the first machine where we can just adjust the anisotropy just by at will. We can even change the anisotropy. You know, we can start with one isotropy and then just change it. We can rotate the anisotropy and see whether the statistics is different from a rotating anisotropy, from a stationary anisotropy, from a homogeneous flow. Does it give you the same results? I mean, what does it give you, right? It's, you can play games now. What we actually will do is, after talking to Steve Pope and others, is to look at decaying anisotropic turbulence. So we will actually make anisotropic turbulence and then just let it decay and measure what the decay looks like. This is something we will be doing. And we found that the C2 is independent of direction, at least the way we have defined it. We also find that the second order structure functions, basically in a length scale up to about, you can't say to an inertial length scale because it's not defined, because the inertial length scale in both directions is different, but to some scale they collapse completely, which is F the order of the integral length scale. We find that this relationship is fulfilled here, so that LZ over LR goes like UZ over UR, which is, by the way, interesting. So this means that, well, it's just exactly what it says. It says that if you measure the radial components, one is higher and the other one is lower. And we see that the Taylor microscale works out. And so what we cannot do is, in our machine, control the correlation lengths independently. They're always coupled. They're always coupled. The way you make the turbulence, the correlation functions are always coupled. Okay, so let me leave you with two remarks. One is that the way you make turbulence in experiments might actually have an impact. When you look at the fine scales of your turbulence, it might not be Kolmogorov, 100% Kolmogorov. It depends a lot on how you introduce, because we estimated if you have a jet like this, we expected that this jet is fully developed by the distance. This thing is a meter across. The opening is 10 centimeters. The interaction region is about, 10, is about 5 orifice diameters across. So we shouldn't have seen much of the generation mechanism anymore. But nevertheless, in the fine scales, we see it. We were actually surprised not to see the two-thirds scaling. We expected to see it. In the French washing machine, for example, we see a nice two-thirds scaling. But what I show you always is a plot of just a reduced plot normalized by 3/2, and it looks flat. Well, I could have used not 3/2, I could have used 2, it would still look flat, right? So the question is really to the eye. I mean, to the eye, anything has a little bump. And the question is, where do you put the bump? And so perhaps in interpreting our data, what I take away as an experimental for this, one has to be a little bit more careful in reducing these curves and really looking at them in detail and saying, what do you see? The other thing is, we find this relationship here, which I found very interesting, because for any technological flow, that means if you change this, you change that, or the other way around, which is actually for mixing, anything you do is very important, because, and this is a good guide, and this number doesn't have to be 3. It could actually only be 2, right? Which is a big difference in the turbulence you're studying. Okay, well, thank you very much. And if you have comments, suggestions, this is work in progress. I would welcome any comments. Thank you.
So 10 years ago, we had a European program called anisotropic turbulence. And within this program, all this SO3 machinery was developed for analyzing this data. And I think one should also apply this here. I mean, this really, one should disentangle the isotropic contribution, anisotropic contribution.
We so have the, talked to Luca at length, yeah.
The correct structure functions are not longitudinal and transversal. You have to really do the SO3 decomposition,
right,
D0,
right.
D1, 0.
That data doesn't allow that.
And, well, I mean...
No, I agree with you.
We have talked to, this is one thing we are about to do, that's why we have done some particle tracking experiments in here now. But the data is not yet good enough to actually do something. The problem is with particle tracking in airflows, the traces have to be very small to get a representation of the flow field. And so with these very small 1 micron particles, we are fine. But then the image is very poor. And so we have data now, we're analyzing it. I agree with you.
This is the correct machinery to apply to this. And of course, it would be good if you have the full.
Well, I mean, one question I have, which I've not seen, is one question to the people that know the machinery better than me is to actually calculate this. I mean, it should be easy, right? I mean, you have the machinery in place, right? You have the SO3 decomposition, you know everything. So you can make an axially anisotropic turbulent flow, and you tell me what power law you find here.
Well, I mean, it will be very non-universal, depending on how you mix the isotropic and anisotropic contributions, and it will be very strongly depend. And this makes your experiment nice, because you can control it. So.
This is decomposition, just a way of presenting data, not like predictions.
Yes. No, it's just the second data. You take out the isotropic sector, right? Yeah. But then
it's
just there's an isotropic sector.
All have their own dependency. So I mean, it's not only the decomposition. So
yeah, let me go with that left since you're sitting there. So what have you learned at the end of the day by doing this decomposition for anything useful? What have you learned?
What do you actually carry away at the end of the day?
I think it's a systematic way to disentangle anisotropic contributions from isotropic contributions. And
okay, so what do you
all have their own intermittency corrections.
So far below everything we've seen here, below any resolution here.
Yeah.
So given this resolution, you can't do it.
It's just second moments, and it's already messy.
Right, this is second moments, right?
Intermittency correction, which is just another universe on this level of...
I'm really talking about the large scales. I'm not even talking about intermittency. I'm not talking about the larger scales of the flow.
Some subtle points, of course, it's important.
No, but even the two-thirds is not really enough.
Here, it's not even two-thirds there, so what's
even for that, you should try to do the...
No, we should, but we have talked to Luca. Luca came by and we tried to analyze the data. We couldn't. It just didn't work with that data. We need better data.
So it was now clear this correlation measurement is done by two-point measurement?
Yeah, just two-point measurements.
We have a
XY translation, you know, just a translation stage, and we just move one laser probe with respect to the other.
Like do simultaneous measurement?
Yeah, just simultaneous. Yeah, sure.
If I'm allowed to make a wish, what I would be most interested from this data is the cross-correlator, I mean, UZ, UR, at two different points, and comparing it with, because it's also degree of anisotropy. Now,
yes.
How this degree of anisotropy decays as you go to small scale, comparing to how the another degree of anisotropy, UR over UZ.
Well, we can do that. We have the data. So
I think that, for example, for anything like pipe channels, shear flows, at least for me, this is the most interesting question. How different degrees of anisotropy decays, because it fundamentally affects the way the turbulence behaves. If we believe that they all decay, not necessarily the same way. And there are maybe even more, but at least with the level of second moments, that's the important question. V1, V2, and V1.
We have looked at the third moment, by the way, but the data is not good enough to say much about it. It's just not good enough. Yes.
Can you simultaneously control the phases of each of the speakers?
Yes, that's what we do.
That's what you do.
We randomize it, right? I mean, they're running all at a 50 hertz carrier frequency,
right?
And we are changing the phases and the amplitudes in such a way that the total amplitude stays constant.
And you're doing that, there's a randomization?
There's a randomization procedure, well-described randomization procedure, which is in our paper, where we make sure that this works, and we could change the phases there and make sure that...
By synchronizing the phases a little more between the different, could you control the integral scale more? In other words, it's a pity that you can't independently control the integral scales. I'm wondering whether by phasing things, let's say all the jets in a particular region to be in phase, Could you affect the integral scale?
Well, they are in phase, right? So it's just, well, what do you mean? In phase, so they all move in at the same time. But then the other guys have to all move out on the other side, which means probably we would end up with a large scale flow. But
large scale flow means a bigger integral scale.
Right, in some sense. So we could try that. We could try to fiddle around. The thing is, the phase space is so enormous, right? I mean, you can now come up with all kinds of different. It's very hard to actually make this flow homogeneous and isolated. Very few people have succeeded in making this loudspeaker flows actually homogeneous and isotropic over a large region, you know, over the energy injection scale. It's not easy because usually you end up with there's a group in Imperial College where they are looking at inertial particles in this flow, and they had a very hard time getting a flow which has a mean velocity of zero and basically is isotropic and homogeneous. And with this little randomization scheme, we can actually, it's robust. You just dump it in, it comes out. So we have two of these machines, I should mention. We have now a new one. So we have two of these machines now in the lab. One of them can go into the SF6 machine where we want to do the particle tracking. I mean, this is just the beginning, so Detlef is right. And where we can do particle tracking at higher Reynolds numbers, so we can go to R lambda 3000. With the same with the same machine. It's a difficult experiment to do, as Kunder can imagine. All these pressure experiments are just difficult. but what's pretty nice is actually that the data collapses out here so well, right? Which is completely outside of the integral length scale, right? The integral length scale is somewhere here, right? And so we're actually collapsing the data out to the really large scales of the flow. Yes?
Yes, I have a more experimental question. You use a lot of energy by your loudspeakers. How stable is the temperature inside your cell? And might it be that you have you have additional convection effects in your...
No, the room is extremely well cooled, so we have seen no temperature changes. Yeah, I mean this thing is cooled from the outside here. So it might go up. Actually, we haven't measured the temperature inside. We should measure it and see whether it goes up. But the loudspeakers are not hot. You know, they're not. If they're hot, you're afraid that there's some local heat sources.
No. What I mean is you have turbulent dissipation inside the box and this.
Sure.
It's uniformly heated.
It's not like it's much. It should be. It's well mixed, right? So it should approach some constant temperature. It's always the same power we put in, right? You should always have the same temperature. The room is well regulated, so we haven't actually worried about this. But yeah,
I don't have an idea how much.
We could put in a thermistor and just measure the temperature fluctuations and see what we get. I mean, another question, of course, is you could go in a regime where the loudspeakers are actually loudspeakers and not pumps. And then you have the interaction of acoustics with turbulence, which is a completely new a new bag of cans, right? But you could do it here, right? You could even go into some funny machine. So you can. These loudspeaker systems are nice, but right now, you know, the turbulence doesn't look too good. I mean, if you look at this 2/3, it doesn't look that great, right? Now, ask me why the French washing machine is so good. Perhaps it's not that good either. It's just that we always plot the data in such a way that it looks good. No, I mean, once you assume a 2/3 scaling, you get a little a flat region, and of course, it's always curved. It always looks like, you know, when you plot the reduced second order structure, the structure function d divided by r to the 2/3, right, and r to the minus 2/3, and what you find is something going, it goes like r squared here, and then it has a little bump and it falls down. Right, and then you say, you know, most of the time you don't have measurement resolution out here. Now these measurements are better because with the particle tracking measurements we have a much higher resolution, much better statistics. Then we get here, we get good statistics along a line, but we don't have a good statistics over, you know, the whole sample. And what we do in the French washing machine is we subtract the mean velocity, because the mean velocity also changes by a factor of 10. It's 0 in the middle, it's 1 meter per second about 10 centimeters away. So what we do is we subtract the mean velocities brutally. So we just subtract the mean velocity. It turns out, if you don't do that for the second order structure function, the second order structure function comes out just fine.
Here you check the mean velocity?
0. Right, we showed that it's pretty close to 0. It's very small. So this is nice. This flow is really nice. You have mean velocity 0 all the way out to the inertial scales. You know, you can tune your anisotropy. You can look at, you know, you can look now at particle clustering, all these other things. That's what we do right now. So we look at particle collisions, for example, in the other system, where we actually ask ourselves, when do inertial particles collide? And what is the radial distribution function? And what is the difference velocity statistics of colliding particles? Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Let's.